Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. And here we are in lockdown podcast week four. And I'm joined again today by Alex Newman, who I spoke to a couple of weeks ago. How are you doing, Alex?
I'm good, thanks. Well, in the circumstances, good. Thanks, John. How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. I'm going to talk later to Phil Oakley about his piece this week, which is looking at the works of Ben Graham, the famous investor, and what we can learn from that in today's very strange markets. But before we do that, we're going to talk about the FTSE 350 review, which we wrote probably 2 months ago, was it, Alex?
Yeah, it was at the end of January. It's the last edition of January. So what feels like a very long 10 weeks ago.
It was a very long 10 weeks ago. And basically, the huge effort that's gone into that appears largely redundant as of today. So what we decided to do was update it. And you've turned that around in super quick time. It's amazing what you've done there, Alex.
Well, I mean, it's a credit to the company's writers for revamping their views on all of the big sectors, really, which has been a big effort this week. We've got it together. And I mean, as you said, views from 10 weeks ago, it's interesting looking back on the coverage we had then, because we did mention the virus a few times, but both us and the broader market were seeing it very much then as a sort of China specific story. And obviously the contagion and the pandemic had yet to materialize. Obviously we're in a completely different world now. So updating the views for what it means for each of the sectors we follow was, I think, something we felt we needed to do.
Indeed. And it all started sort of with a big spreadsheet as well, didn't it? So we basically got a list of all the constituents of the FTSE 350 and then kind of broke down all the sort of various types of impact that they were reporting. So there is this enormous document sitting behind this huge effort.
Yeah, which readers we'll have access to them, and we're gonna try and keep it updated in the weeks ahead. I think this is mainly because we cover all these companies, but we were drowning in the number of updates and just the implications of what lots of companies are saying. So, you know, sometimes we're just getting kind of almost throwaway trading updates where companies are warning on liquidity, saying earnings visibility has vanished, pulling guidance, the sort of things which would you know, normally make the business front pages in any ordinary year. So we wanted to kind of collate it all into one digestible format, hopefully, where investors in the biggest companies listed in London have a reference point to try and get their thinking together, hopefully.
So we've sort of grouped all the sort of various impacts and actions. So we've got things like, you know, all of the sort of dividend cuts, capital programs that have been cut, all that sort of thing, and groups as easy for readers to see.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, whether guidance is still there, in the majority of cases it's either been pulled or it's been sharply reduced. Other kind of cost cutting measures which companies have announced to try and either shore up their balance sheets or just hold the fort for the coming months. So it's a sort of condensed version of the RNSs and announcements that companies have been putting out in the past month and a half.
It's an amazing document, and we're going to be releasing that to the public. Well, okay, I don't know when this is going to get released to the public, at some point in the next day or so. So thanks for your effort on that, Alex, and all the team. It's been amazing. So what we're going to do now is, rather than me interviewing you about 350 companies in the FTSE 350, you've got some of the team on the Hangouts, which is what we're using to record this, and you're going to speak to them about what the particular impacts on their sectors are. So I will hand over to you now, Alex, and get the rest of the team in this conversation.
Yeah, which is reassuring. So I'm not quite sure I could keep 350 companies in my head at one time. From the companies team, we have...
I'm Alex Hamer. I'm the resources writer at Investor Chronicle. So I've been looking at oil and gas and mining companies. Like for everyone, it's been a big few weeks for us.
We've also have Emma.
Hi, I'm Emma Powell. And I cover property, so ranging from house builders to office landlords, retail landlords. And yeah, again, there's been a slew of updates in recent weeks.
And finally, we've got Alex Janio as well.
Hi, I'm Alex Janio, consumer business correspondent now. So I've spent the past year and a bit covering industrials as well and still dabble in the odd industrial company. What I'll be discussing today.
Brilliant. So I'm going to ask each of you in turn for a brief overview of one of the many eclectic sectors you cover. Alex Hamer, you've been looking, among other things, at mining. So just in very broad terms, how has the virus impacted the mining sector?
I guess a good way to look at it would be from the ground up. Mines are huge enterprises with, you know, hundreds if not thousands of employees. A lot of them are in remote areas, so a bit insulated, but a lot of them have actually seen a few positive cases. So looking in South America, in Peru and Chile, mines have been closed because of positive cases or even just as a way to try and stop the spread of COVID. Most recently, a mine in Panama, so one of the world's biggest copper mines, has just been suspended. So it's kind of on the ground, it's been mines closed temporarily. And then more broadly, companies have seen commodities prices drop. So copper, for example, a few other base metals, and basically everything but gold has seen a fair drop. So it's pretty widespread. The interesting thing has been that iron ore has come down a little bit, but because of the way steelmaking works, where smelters need to keep running, it's really expensive to stop them and get them going again, the iron ore price has actually remained fairly high, even though it is reliant on China for demand.
Is the knock-on effect of that we've just got enormous stockpiling then in Chinese warehouses? What's the slightly longer-term view for the steel sector?
Well, the iron ore price might come down in the coming weeks. A few analysts have said it will, but the iron ore has been able to make it to port, so mostly from Australia, some from South America. And from there, there's been a little bit of difficulty in transporting. You know, these are millions of tonnes, so they need to be transported by rail and truck from the port system to the steelmakers, and that's where there have been some problems. But, you know, all in all, it's kind of kept to about $80 a tonne, and it might actually be when the supply chains inside China recover that we see the price coming down. So there is a bit of stockpiling, but not enough to cause, you know, a glut of supply.
So that's good news for the big iron ore producers, Rio and BHP particularly. How have they fared so far?
They haven't fared too badly. I think, you know, on the 9th of March, the sell-off affected pretty much everyone. But they're trading, I think, only 10-15% down at that point now. Their other commodities, so for London investors, the big ones for dividends especially are Rio Tinto, BHP, Anglo American, and Glencore. And all those companies, you know, they're fairly positive. Glencore's paused its dividend decision. They haven't cut the dividend entirely. But, yeah, the noise coming out of the companies is that they're a little bit worried about operational shutdowns, but this isn't the massive crisis that it would have been if they had the balance sheets of 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, so I mean that was obviously the really big concern when prices collapsed in the years to 2016, when those are really leveraged balance sheets. This time round, are they going to be able to sustain a, you know, prolonged shutdown potentially of some of their mines and commodity prices? You know, if not on the floor, then deeply depressed.
They're in a much better position. I think I was just looking at Glencore's debt position over the last few years. And in 2015-16, their leverage was over 60%. Now it's still fairly high. It's 44%, what was at the end of 2019, but that's with an extra $1 billion put on their liability line through the new accounting rules. So they're a bit below 40%. Rio and BHP have been quite successful in cutting debt as well. You know, if you listen to the new BHP chief executive, Mike Henry, speaking in February, he was talking about kind of, you know, supercharging the company and talking about how all the balance sheet work was done, basically. And it was his decision to manage the portfolio and try and get, you know, more returns for investors, obviously up the valuation, which they want to do at all times, and kind of look at where BHP was going to go next. And they've got some big capital decisions coming up. You know, they've already spent a few billion on a mine they haven't even given the green light to, the fertilizer project in Canada. But I think, you know, that they've obviously gone from that position in February to now just trying to, you know, pull some different levers, cut costs further, even though they've done a really good job in cutting those costs, especially in, you know, the iron ore operations in Western Australia, which are kind of key to their operations. So it's a very different conversation, but overall, to answer your question, they are in a much better position now. We might see some dividends disappear for a little while, just so they have a bit more money to use over the coming months and year or so. But yeah, this isn't a critical time where we have to wonder whether the big miners will survive.
Okay, Alex, thanks. Thanks so much for that. Well, so from some pockets of potential support to an area where things are looking pretty ropey. Emma, if I can bring you in now, we can talk about a couple of elements of broader real estate property market. But I mean, first, let's start where the pain seems to be the greatest, and that's with landlords. So, I mean, can you just put it into sort of figures or terms? How badly currently is the, you know, as social lockdown and the stress of tenants affecting the retail and commercial property owners?
Well, perhaps unsurprisingly, you know, we had the kind of quarterly rent collection date kind of last week of March, first week of April for the second quarter. A lot of landlords, very few collected 100% of the rent or even rent in line with last year. The kind of worst affected, unsurprisingly, were retail landlords. So Hammerson collected 29% of its rent that was billed. Hammerson, which has a 50% stake in Bicester Village and also owns the Bullring and, you know, has other interests in kind of major retail shopping centres, outlets, they collected just 37% of their rent. So much reduced. I think the issue for a lot of these retail landlords is that obviously a lot of retailers were under quite a lot of stress even before the COVID-19 outbreak. Their cash flows were already constrained. So, you know, you have this lockdown and it's really, really putting a lot of pressure onto them. Office landlords, which obviously have kind of retail and food and beverage outlets often on the ground floor around the offices, they again have seen, you know, some reduction in rent collection. Some have held it better than others. So people like Derwent and CLS actually had updates out today. They've performed quite well, collected over 80% of their rents. But again, yeah, they've seen a shortfall, obviously, there.
In immediate terms, what does this mean for shareholders in these companies? It sounds like obviously we've got a wide range of scenarios here. Some maybe are getting the cash in. Others, it sounds like are probably struggling to manage their cash flows at the moment. What are you expecting in the next month or so?
I mean, it really depends, I suppose, on kind of how much headroom they've got within their debt covenants. So you've got someone like Into, which, you know, they came out even in March and said they're getting close to breaching anyway. Then you've got others that've got kind of considerable headroom, so they can withstand quite severe falls in the value of the assets and also the kind of rental income. So it really depends on the kind of headroom they've got. I suppose the question for the longer term really is when lockdown lifts, how many of these retailers will be even left in business? And also, I suppose, the kind of rental reductions that they might try to negotiate with landlords even further once they begin trading again, which I suppose is a kind of bigger issue over the longer term when estimated rental values were already falling long before this kind of outbreak happened.
So this absolutely isn't a case of buying the dip or looking for bargains. It's a short term hit and then a potentially a longer term greater pain as well.
Sorry, yeah, exactly. You know, we've been bearish on kind of retail landlords for a while now because before the COVID-19 outbreak, they were facing such structural challenges to their businesses, you know?
Yeah. From an area of the property market, which was already looking pretty challenged, to one which, going into this crisis at least, looked to be in better health, even if people were slightly less positive on the outlook for house sales. House builders, I mean, with house purchases essentially on hold, that's going to be tricky for them. How bad is the hit going to be this year? And are we starting to see any signs that they may be affected by falling property prices? Brings up speed on how things are going there.
Yeah, so obviously as the lockdowns kind of taken place, obviously work stopped on construction sites. they're losing, obviously, they're going to lose a lot of sales from that. Unsurprisingly, then, obviously, we've seen kind of dividend cuts from most of the house builders. They've stopped buying any new land. I mean, they're doing what a lot of companies are doing in terms of trying to boost their cash reserves. Actually, we've seen a placing from Gleeson today. You'd expect more to kind of follow with that. But I suppose the kind of question in terms of house prices when the lockdown lifts is really going to be dependent on whether we are heading for a kind of longer term economic downturn or even recession, where you would kind of see property prices, house prices fall. And I think I wrote in my piece a couple of weeks ago about how house builders are very sensitive to footfalls in sales prices, just because they've got quite a low level of operational gearing. So I've seen estimates that every 1% fall in sales prices impacts operating profits on average by about 5%. So they're very, very sensitive to sales prices, but I suppose it's kind of good to look cautiously towards the sector, but it really will depend in terms of sales prices on the kind of broader economic outlook.
So all these dividend cuts, despite their massive cash pools on the balance sheets, it doesn't sound like that's too much of an overreaction given how uncertain things are.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. Particularly, obviously, you've got a big chunk of, and let's not forget, obviously, this is the kind of key spring summer sales season, right? Yeah. I mean, forward sales will mitigate some of the impact, but no, I think it's definitely not an overreaction from them.
Okay, Emma, thanks so much for bringing us up to speed on the property market. Alex Janio, if I can turn to you, I mean, among your very eclectic list of sectors you've written about in this magazine are supermarkets and airlines, which we've covered in a lot of depth in recent weeks. One of the sectors which we can sometimes give slightly less coverage to, just because they're in some ways less familiar names to investors, is sort of electronics and hardware. Obviously that covers a broad remit of companies, but in general terms, how has the virus impacted the hardware and electronics sector?
Thanks, Alex. So yes, you're right. I mean, a lot of these companies, they do all do fairly different things, but there are some binding themes. These industrial players working in electronics and hardware. It's worth bearing in mind that most of these businesses are already quite heavily exposed to sluggish economic growth, business sentiment last year, and the US-China trade war. And actually had a thesis kind of towards the end of last year when coronavirus, as you said, looked like a China-specific problem. Well, a lot of these companies actually had to move their operations out of China in order to mitigate against that. And so I thought, well, actually, maybe has that kind of almost helped insulate them? The answer is now with the global pandemic, no. And one executive did tell me last year also, you know, once you move out, you don't go back. But, you know, considering, you know, now it is a question of considering sort of supply and demand. So which companies are mostly exposed in their production, their supply to China? The answer is quite a few of them. Morgan and Advanced Materials at Oxford Instruments, for example, produce a fair amount in China. They've both actually registered and noticed a recent upturn in business sentiment, output. They've been able to reopen their factories as we see the coronavirus pandemic recede. So perhaps now more it's a question of demand and budgets, capital expenditure being slashed elsewhere. There's less demand for industrial products, and that will probably, as we see with the potential for recession for the rest of the year, hit these companies hard in the long term as opposed to just short-term production supply.
Okay, thanks for that overview. I suppose the other element for industrials, obviously, is the thing to pay attention to for investors is cash flow and working capital. Are we seeing any pinch points in how the supply chains may be disrupted or demand may be falling very sharply in some areas, which are affecting some companies more than others?
I mean, generally, we're seeing quite a lot of outflows, particularly with companies' exposure to automotives. Businesses are taking actions to shore up their balance sheets. We're seeing dividend cuts everywhere, along with executive pay reductions and drawing down the credit lines, also along with deferred sort of non-essential capital expenditure. those businesses.
There are self-help measures that companies in particular, you know, which might be looking in trouble, which they can bring to the table.
Yes, and actually a fair amount of these companies, pretty liquid already. I mean, Renishaw the directors already waived their rights to the dividend and they've withdrawn that, but they're in a pretty healthy net cash position of 71.3 million. Oxford Instruments, another company with net cash of 60 million. So investors may be thinking, well, the growth rates expected for the coming years will be pretty slow. They're pretty defensive and resilient businesses right now.
Good stuff. Alex, thanks for the overview there on the industrial sector.
Brilliant. Thanks, everyone. That was absolutely fascinating. Thank you, Alex, for hosting that. I mean, there's lots more sectors we've covered. We didn't cover every sector, did we, Alex? What have we looked at in the update?
So in the normal 50-350 roundup, I think it comes to 30-odd sectors. So we've tried to condense them to the sort of the 20 most recognisable or most followed sectors. So elsewhere in there, we've got insurers, banks, obviously the supermarkets and general retail. Yeah, lots more in there. So all the big names, particularly, you know, where dividends are involved as well, we've tried to give our view there. And if companies which investors and listeners do hold aren't listed there, then again, as we said, that spreadsheet that we've put together and we'll try and keep updating is another good reference point for how companies are doing.
Okay, thanks everyone. That was really, really interesting. Thank you very much, Alex, for arranging that. And obviously, there are a lot more sectors that we've covered in the piece. I'd encourage everyone to go away and read that. Thank you all. So now I'm joined by Phil Oakley on the Hangout to talk about his magazine column this week and what he makes of the topsy-turvy markets that we're seeing. The magazine column is actually inspired very much by the works of Benjamin Graham, in particular his seminal book, The Intelligent Investor. Phil, tell us why these times and when markets are doing what they're doing, it's probably a really good time to be paying very much attention to what Benjamin Graham observed about stock markets back in the distant past.
And I think it's fair to say that Intelligent Investor is one of the best books on investing for the private investor. It was written for the private investor and has, you know, is packed full of lots of good advice, explained really well in a way that most seasoned private investors can understand. Now, obviously, with all books that, you know, the book was first written in 1949, and the last book that Graham wrote about was in the early 1970s. As with all investment books, they do age, and sometimes what was discussed 50, 70 years ago isn't really applicable today. But there are two chapters within that book. Chapter 8, which deals with fluctuating stock prices or investment prices in general, or volatility, as people call it today. And chapter 20, which is the margin of safety, something called the margin of safety, which is what Graham and probably Warren Buffett as well see as the main thing that investors should concentrate when they're buying shares. What I've decided to do is to take those two things, explain what they mean, and then try them apply them to the current stock market. So how should the investor think about the current fluctuations in today's stock market, and is there a margin of safety in buying shares now?
Let's start with the fluctuations, because that's obviously the thing that's on people's minds most at the moment. Markets fluctuate all the time, as you say, and as Graham observed. But what happens when you get big fluctuations like we're seeing at the moment is it generates a massive emotional response, which fuels those big fluctuations even more. Talk about the sort of behavioural aspects of what we're seeing today.
I mean, what Graham says is that, you know, and it's much easier said than done, we all know this, is that you shouldn't get spooked out by these wild fluctuations, and you should use the market as your servant to take advantage of as you can. So when prices fall and valuations of shares become more attractive, you should buy. And when they get too high and there's too much optimism or they're over optimistic about a company's future, you should use the market, the price that it's offering you, to sell. And what I think is interesting about the current market is that it's quite hard, I think, to see the fall in the market that we've seen between sort of the middle of February and the middle of March as really offering opportunities to buy. Hindsight's a wonderful thing, because what hindsight's telling us that you know, you've seen the rally back since then. You know, and we've seen it in, you know, the battered shares, you know, in the travel shares. Now, I mentioned the National Express is one that I've kept an eye on recently because I've written about it, and that's pretty much doubled in the last 2-3 weeks. A lot of these shares have come back quite strongly. But has there been any kind of, you know, this, let me sort of get onto the margin of safety bit. Could you have safely predicted the company's earnings conservatively over the next few years to come to the conclusion that the shares were a screaming buy? And I think some of them maybe you could. You know, I mentioned National Express in an article and also in the Alpha reports and on this podcast that, you know, those shares got very, very depressed. And that if you took a very conservative view of what those profits could come back to, and I think, you know, WH Smith is the same, then you could have made the case for saying that you could buy the shares now, and you might have a reasonable chance of making a good return. What you don't know is what your share of the profits is going to be. And obviously we've seen WH Smith place nearly 14% of its share capital this week, so you get diluted. And obviously you just don't know whether a highly indebted company like National Express has to do the same.
And I guess we also don't really know to what extent earnings will bounce back to where they were before and over what time frame.
Absolutely. You know, I think the assumption that, you know, we can sweep this all under the carpet and that businesses that have been closed down or suppressed can be essentially brought back to life as quickly as flicking a light switch, I think is wishful thinking.
I mean, one of my worries about the idea of, you know, buying shares that are even cheaper than they were before is that, A, because we don't really have that earnings context, we don't know what a true valuation actually is. But also, and because we don't know what a true valuation actually is, we're just speculating. And, you know, this is something I think you mentioned that Ben Graham points out is, you know, he's an investor. If you're not using some kind of fundamental analysis, you are in the business of speculation. And that is a risky business to be in.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think what this boils down to is three things, and these are applicable all the time, not just when you've got extreme levels of volatility. You start with the business first. Always start with the business when you're looking at investment, and you look at the quality, stability, and visibility of its profits. What we've seen is that companies with highly profitable companies with very stable, predictable profits tend to do well if they can grow. And we've seen that in the upswing and we've seen that in the downswing, that they've protected investors better than those that haven't got those characteristics. The other thing is the price that you pay. And so the investment versus the speculation is a combination between paying the right price, not overpaying, and buying a good business. And where you don't get the protection is in cheap shares in poor quality businesses, because they get found out at times like this and you find out why they were cheap in the first place.
But I mean, there is another aspect to this, and you've written about it in your columns, Phil, which is that even a quality business, or, you know, what people have been describing as quality lately, which seems to offer predictable earnings, predictable growth, even businesses like that, and I think you write about Microsoft in your column this week and have done before, isn't entirely immune to what's going on in the wider economy. So even there, you know, with these quality companies, there is surely an element of speculation which is not built into current valuations.
Absolutely. You know, I think we're going to find out over the next few weeks and months that there are few companies with bulletproof earnings. And that leads you on to, you know, if we talk about Microsoft, because Microsoft's a good example. And I think, you know, most of our listeners understand what Microsoft does. You come to the valuation of the shares. And this is a company that's on over 30 times its last 12 months trailing earnings per share. So the valuation is high. If you look at Graham, always used to turn PEs upside down and express them as not price over earnings, but earnings over price. And I actually prefer that because it gives you an interest rate. I always think that people can understand interest rates much easier than they can understand a number, because people understand an interest rate on a savings account and a bond. So why not express the valuation of a share in interest rate? So if you look at what the valuation of Microsoft is at the moment, it's about 3%. That's your earnings over the share price. So if you were buying that business, that is what your claim on that share is. It's 3%. Now, that's a very low rate of interest historically. It's seen as attractive, or has been seen as attractive, because there's no return anywhere else. And that return can grow. But if you look at the way that you make money from a share, there's only two ways, there's essentially two ways that you make money from a share. Earnings growth, which then some of that may get paid out to you in a dividend, and a rise in the share price, which is again driven by the earnings. But to make money from Microsoft from here, starting with a very low 3% return, you've got to believe that earnings will grow very strongly, which they might, and also that the market will continue to accept a very low interest rate on the shares, a very high PE ratio. Now, for the last few years, it has done that. But whether it will continue to do so, I don't know, and nobody knows. I think most people assume that interest rates on bonds and cash are probably not going up anytime soon. But the other thing I think that people, and I didn't write about this in the piece, I've written about this in my Alpha report, is inflation. People have accepted owning bonds which yield less than inflation. But let's say inflation goes to 5%. Yeah? Will people be prepared to own Microsoft on a 3% earnings yield? Now, I'm not saying that inflation is gonna take off, but there is a risk with all this money printing, potential shortages, the ability of the economy to respond in terms of supplying goods that have been shut down. There is a risk that we could get some inflation. There's also a risk that Microsoft earnings will disappoint. And this is where it comes back to, you know, I think you're paying a very high price for perceived quality. Microsoft's one of the better shares that you could probably bank on. But there are so many other companies out there which trade on these very low interest rates, very high PE ratios, that the margin of safety in relation to, you know, that business's future prospects is actually quite low.
Yeah, you've actually put a little table together in the magazine piece looking at actually how some very good quality businesses, what's driven their share price performance is not necessarily earnings growth, but re-rating, rating expansion.
Yeah, and there's two really good examples in the UK. Two excellent businesses, Spirex Sarco, which I think is one of the best businesses listed on the UK Stock Exchange, has incredibly stable profits. You know, its profit margin has stayed in the sort of low 20% right through the last sort of 15 years or so, right through the Great Recession, the financial crisis, been rock solid. And it's a superb business. But if you actually look at that business over the last 15 years, 15 years ago, you probably picked this share up on 15 times earnings or something like that.
14.6, now, Phil.
How much, sorry?
14.6.
All right. There we are. Yeah. And now it's on what, about 35?
34.1.
Yeah. So it's on, this is trailing earnings per share. Now, the earnings have grown over that time. But if you had just taken the earnings of, and in the magazine, I look at the P 15 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, and look at what the share price would have been if you just apply the increases in earnings to those PE ratios. I think over the last 15 years, about a, you know, I think most, you know, a huge chunk of the increase, let me put it into numbers. If the PE had stayed the same on Spirax Sarco as it was 15 years ago, and you look at the earnings growth, the shares would be about £33 today. They're, last time I looked, they were 82. And I think with Halmer, again, you've got a similar discrepancy. So you've seen a huge re-rating of these shares. And clearly the margin of safety at 14 times PE is a lot higher than it is at 35. And, you know, for years, we've had a situation where low interest rates, money printing, basically don't fight the Fed, and also the lack of any real alternative has driven the share prices of these businesses to very, very high levels. Valuations to very high levels.
Hey, I mean, one thing I would say, though, Phil, is, I mean, you know, you mentioned there is no alternative. There is still no alternative. Is this what's driving the markets back, you know, to where they came from?
Yeah, I was about to say that. Yeah, I mean, there is still no alternative, but the risks are going up. I'm being offered to buy a business for 3% return, and I don't know what it's going to earn. I don't know, you know, when things were normal. You know, do you remember this whole sort of bond proxy type argument?
Absolutely.
I wouldn't say that Halmer and Spirax Sarco were bond proxies, by the way.
No, I think we're talking more to the Unilevers of this world.
Yeah. The visibility, yes, is better than most. And I'm sure, you know, Unilever has sold quite a lot more food in the last few months. But they aren't completely bond-like. You know, and then you've got the argument, you know, with the likes of Unilever is, you know, it has been struggling to grow. It faces competition. It's not just, you know, we tend to be talking, the discussion at the moment is very much sort of a macro type, general economy type thing. And we've also got to take into account that these companies face their own specific business and competitive issues as well. And that is risk. That is risk, and it all comes down to, you know, how has the stock market priced risk? And the issue is that even for businesses that are perceived to be lower risk, the price attached to those shares has now become very high, even in this current market where we are today.
I know the way you sum it up in your magazine article is that also that the predictability they offer is nowhere near as good as it once was. So risk is mispriced, and you also have a worse idea of where these businesses will be in a few years' time.
Yeah, I would say, look, businesses that are perceived to be less risky are priced very highly, which makes them risky for investors.
We talked about emotion, you know, driving this market behaviour we're seeing. Is there a danger that we look around us and, you know, it isn't great and we're stuck indoors, that you and I and others are perhaps being overly pessimistic?
I do acknowledge that. Put my hands up and say, yes, there is that. And, you know, we could be in a situation where we look back on this kind of conversation and say, look, we got it wrong. We were a bit too pessimistic.
Yeah,
I'd counter that. You're trying to be dispassionate about this. You can only go on what you can see. And investors are always in a position where they don't know the future. The assumption is that the future will be very similar to the present and the recent past. And, you know, we've come along with something like this and nobody knows what to do because they've never seen it before. They just assume that, oh, yeah, it'll go away. But I actually think that what this is a turning point for me, because I've long held the view that the foundations of the economy, you know, the actual thing that leads to the flow of money between...
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about...
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
People and businesses and businesses and businesses and the flow of cash has been on a shaky ground for a while in terms of the amount of debt, particularly the amount of debt, particularly things like low rates of earnings, of wage growth. And I think there are lots of problems. And I think this low interest rate world and, you know, the money printing that's gone on for the last 11 years has papered over a lot of cracks.
Yeah, but, I mean, it seems to be happening again. I mean, and I came across a great blog by a guy called Michael Batnick called The Irrelevant Investor, and he was kind of dismissive of the idea that some have been touting that, you know, we are on the cusp of a new Great Depression.
I read that.
And his point, which I think is an interesting one, is that, yes, you know, we are seeing, and I think he describes it as the quickest destruction of business fundamentals that we have ever seen. But on the other hand, the government is pumping trillions of dollars into the economy, so everything's going to be okay. But isn't that the thing that's got us into this trouble in the first place?
Yeah, and I think it assumes that money printing is a free lunch, right? And so far, you can forgive people for thinking that money printing has been a free lunch because it's inflated bonds, bond prices, share prices, property prices, and there's been no consequences to pay in terms of what we all pay for our goods and services. And that's because a lot of the money that was printed went into the financial markets. It didn't actually go into the real economy. Okay, some of it went into mortgages and that kind of thing. This time, I think it's slightly different in two ways. One is that you are getting unprecedented amounts of money chucked at this, a lot more than the financial crisis. And also, some of that money is going to end up in the pockets of households. And that's going to get spent. So that money is going to enter circulation. Now, if that creates inflation, that is a price that we will have to pay. So that is part of the bill. The other thing as well is that the deficits of Western economies, in fact, you know, most economies, government deficits, are just going to go through the roof. And the question is, how do you pay for those deficits? And, you know, after the war, Second World War, which is what people refer back to in terms of, you know, such a big shock to government finances as we're seeing now, taxes went up. You know, taxes went up. Could taxes go up again? And, you know, how does the government actually balance the books? Or do we just say, well, it doesn't matter, you know, interest rates are so low, we can get our friends in the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve, they can just pay for all this? And because everybody is doing the same thing and, you know, currencies are a relative game, it all comes out in the wash and it's happy days. That's the kind of, you know, argument that, you know, you've got to seriously consider that, you know, you might think it's flawed, but you think, okay, this might be all right for a bit.
I mean, it sounds to me like just creating money out of thin air, which is a hard thing to get your head around.
It's a very hard thing to get your thing around. We've seen it done historically, and we've seen it end very badly. And I think, you know, if... What we don't know is at the moment we're seeing a lot of money being sucked out, seeing a huge downward force on the economy. And therefore, you're trying to keep that. It's like trying to keep a fire going, yeah? So if you assume that, you know, money is wood for a fire, you're throwing wood onto the fire to keep it burning. And you might be throwing a bit of petrol on it as well. And I think the thing that nobody knows is that, you know, what happens if, you know, we all want to come out of this, you know, we all want to get back to where we were. But assuming we can do this without having to pay a price, I'm not sure that's the right. I'm not sure we can get away with that. And I think that this is another thing that the stock market doesn't seem to want to price. It doesn't, you know, I wish I wasn't having this conversation. You know, I wish that, you know, I could look at this in a much more favourable way. But I'm finding it really hard.
I would just like to talk about companies, Phil, and their businesses and their fundamental valuations. It doesn't seem like we can do that at the moment, really.
Look, I could easily sit back here and just say, oh, don't worry, just buy and hold, and you'll be all right, because you've always been all right buying and holding. Well, that's actually a lie if you're a UK investor. Buy and hold has not been great.
On the FTSE 100?
Well, even, you know, if you look at buy and hold on the S&P 500, going back, this is like 20%. This is 20 years. So from the dot-com crash to the recent peak, I think the total annual shareholder return was about 4.8%. That's all right. You know, that's better than inflation, which is what investors are always trying to do. They're always trying to grow the buying power of their money. But you've taken a hell of a lot of risk to achieve actually quite a low return over the last 20 years. Yeah, the returns look great over the last 10 years. But most people, you know, over 20, you know, you can make returns look great to suit your argument. I've just done it. You know, I've just done it over 20 years. You know, it's hard. And I don't know, is the answer. I think I've never struggled as much in trying to work out what's going on. The 23 years I've been doing this.
I don't think you're alone, Phil. I don't think you're alone. It's a very bizarre time. I was just going back to the point about, you know, who's paying. I actually was sent some research by one of my colleagues, Alex Newman, who you heard earlier from BofA Securities, talking about tax and what increases in tax could do to corporate earnings as well. So I think the research says something like 5% increase in corporate tax will mean a 6% reduction in the value of European equities. So yes, when the bill is presented at some point in the future, that has to have a negative impact on equity prices.
Absolutely, yeah. There's a bill to be paid here.
Now, yeah, it does seem to be the bit that we're forgetting. The one thing I would perhaps suggest is we often hear, though, the argument that if there is an inflationary environment, equities is also the place to be.
Well, that depends how big inflation is. I mean, I talk to people who, you know, who remember the 1970s, and where you had very high rates of inflation, and the stock market was a awful place to be in 1974. I've worked with people who were in the market in 1974, and things were so bad. You know, I think the London market went down to a PE of 4 in 1974, and this is when inflation was, you know, over 20%. And I know things got so bad that stockbrokers got one person who used to be a very senior stockbroker in one of the businesses I work for, actually got a milk round in 1974 because things were so bad. And that's an example of what, you know, very high inflation can do to stock markets. I think in the general view that stocks are an inflation hedge has worked well when inflation has been quite moderate. But you see, the only reason that stocks have been seen as a hedge is because companies have been able to increase their prices. to cover their costs. And the only thing I would say is we live in a different world now where the bargaining power of workers is nowhere near as what it was 30, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, where they were able to get wage rises to cover the cost of rising prices, and it caused no end of problems and things, something called a wage price spiral. Everything just kept feeding on each other. And, you know, companies may be able to put up prices, but, you know, whether the consumer, their incomes go up in line with rising prices, we don't know. And that's what you need for stocks to be a hedge, because if your customer hasn't got enough money to pay for it, then they're going to buy less of what you sell.
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, I mean, there seem to be a lot of big unknowns out there. And
we're going down some very dark paths, aren't we, John?
We are. Should we end on a positive note? I know you've been impressed with one company this week that's put out some results. Tesco. Let's talk Tesco.
I used to loathe this company when I actually was an analyst on Tesco very briefly about 16, 17 years ago. I used to hate it then because I thought it had become, you know, a very arrogant company. I thought its growth, the quality of its growth was actually quite poor. It was just basically building out its land bank and buying up stuff.
All of that turned out to be true, Phil.
Yeah. And it's been humbled. It's been humbled. And the guy who's been running it for the last five and a bit years, who's leaving, done a really good job. And you're beginning to, you know, you're seeing that, you know, the ship has been definitely stabilised, and it's been, you've got a very clean, much cleaner business now in Tesco. Things are still quite tough though, but you know, the results that came out yesterday were really quite good, with a couple of caveats. And the profits were up, you know, nearly 14%. The cash flow of the business, the supermarkets business, you know, is really, really good. This business now generating, you know, £2 billion of underlying free cash flow, up from about 800 and a bit a year ago. And it's doing it through rising profits. In the past, you know, Tesco had always generated a lot of its cash flow from squeezing its suppliers. And it seems to be treating its suppliers a lot better these days, which is good to see. And we've got a big increase in the dividend. We've got nearly 60% increase in the dividend. The caveat is that things are tough out there still. There was virtually no revenue growth. And, you know, I still think that the big four supermarkets have got the wrong business model to do well in this UK market. They're too big. Their stores are too big. They're selling too many goods and their costs are too high per square foot. You know, you can't compete. You know, if you've got a supermarket with 30, 40,000 different items in there and you've got, you know, 50,000 plus square feet of selling space, it's very difficult to compete with Aldi and Lidl, who are on 15, 20,000 square feet, selling only 1,500 goods with concentrated buying, very lean operation, and can just outcompete you on price. But Tesco's actually, out of the big four, Tesco's has actually done it quite well. It's had a bit of help on the way with, I think buying Booker has definitely helped it in terms of buying power and cost savings and that kind of thing. But this business looks to be in a pretty good place now. It's probably not going to grow very much, but I think that it will generate lots of cash. It will probably still take out a bit of cost. And it's got a customer offer, which is a lot better than certainly its other big competitors. And what that should lead to is that it should be able to have a modest growth in its dividend. It's an income stock now. It's not a growth stock. It looks like it's going to take a bit of a hit this year from all the extra running costs and staff wages. You know, if this sort of lockdown continues for quite a long time, we're talking about nearly £1 billion of extra cost And some there's about 600 million savings from not paying business rates. But the one thing that can save Tesco is volume, is selling more stuff. Because if it sells more stuff, it makes more profit, gross profit, and that can pay these costs. So with a bit of luck, this is a business that probably can do okay from a profit point of view. The one sort of cloud is on the bank, Tesco Bank. Makes about 200 million of profit out of a total profit of about 3 billion for Tesco as a whole. And it's actually, you know, quite a good bank. You know, it's got a 20%, what's known as a tier one capital ratio of about 20%, which is essentially it's like its equity and its buffer against losses. And it's going to need that buffer because it looks like it's expecting a lot of its customers or enough of its customers to default on their loans. And good chance that bank's going to go from making nearly 200 million of profit to making a loss next year. And that's a sort of a bit of a cloud. But on the positive side, they are getting over $10 billion or over £8 billion of money from selling their Thai and Malaysian business. And that means they're going to be able to completely pay off the pension fund deficit of $2.5 billion, which will also help cash flow in future years. And shareholders are going to get $5 billion special dividend, which is about 51p a share. So I'm not saying this is a great business, but I think, you know, you look at the shares, they're offering a yield on the annual dividend of about 4.3, special dividend on that, cash flow is good, debt's coming down. It's still in a tough market, but, you know, we're looking at a stock market today where the reliability of dividends has really been exposed. And this looks a good place to me.
Indeed, a rare haven in today's markets. There you go. Cheers, Phil. Thank you very much. That's been really useful. I think, you know, it highlights some of the difficulties investors face at the moment. And we've sort of rounded up a lot of those difficulties, as we've already discussed in our FTSE 350 update this month. Let me talk you through what else we have in the magazine. Talking of Tesco, Algie Hall is looking at blue chip shares that are actually doing okay and holding their own during the sell-off. On the subjects of income, we're looking at healthcare property REITs, one of the few segments of the property market that's proving resilient to this downturn. We've got John Barron, along with lots of other comment in the magazine from Chris and Michael Taylor, the trader. Results are coming back in. We've got a couple this week again, but it seems that companies will start reporting. We'll start reporting them in the magazine from next week. Thank you all for listening. Thanks again, Phil.
Thank you, John.
As I said, the big feature this week is the FTSE 350 COVID-19 update, which the team did an amazing job pulling together. Pick it up in all good news agents if you can find one, or get along to Tesco, because I'm pretty sure that they're still open and stocking the Investors Chronicle. Or get online and subscribe, where you can also pick up the massive spreadsheet that we've put together with every FTSE 350 company, every impact from the COVID-19 virus, and every corporate action that they've taken as a result. And we'll be keeping that updated in the weeks ahead, but you need a digital sub to read it. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back again next week. Speak soon and stay safe.